In this episode of The Ownership Economy, Jahed and I sit down with Dr. Ellen Frank Miller, the founder and CEO of Work. An economist by training, Dr. Frank Miller details out her research on how investing in people as assets is proven to build more profitable, competitive companies. This episode will be of particular interest to private equity investors, managers, and anyone who's trying to find a meaningful place to work. We hope you enjoy the episode. Ellen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Cool. So we like to start these podcasts out by hearing a little bit about your background, your origin story, so to speak. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So actually, my undergraduate degree is in economics, and I started my career in HR consulting. And this was in the 90s. So the biggest problem we were facing with clients around their workforce issues was about work and family conflict, work and family balance, work and family programs and policies, and sort of this realization. I was working with Hewitt Associates at the time, so large companies, Fortune 50. There was this realization that, you know, wow, our workplace is designed for a breadwinner and a homemaker. And yet there are all these professional women in the workforce who can't quite manage in this structure. And we're losing all of this talent. We must do something about this. So that was really kind of what we began to work with. And over time, we found that there were just issues related to this topic that we didn't know how to solve for our clients with regard to their lower level workforces, you know, where they're what we now are referring to often as deskless workers. And there just wasn't a good evidence base to work from. And so after a while, I left HR consulting and went to earn my PhD at the University of Chicago to specifically focus on lower wage workers beyond even work and family issues, but issues of job quality for kind of those frontline folks to look at how can we solve problems for workers in ways that benefit business. And so that research really was what I focused on. And if you've ever heard of a Fair Work Week ordinance, which many major cities around the country have, which basically requires certain employers, particularly in retail and in fast food, to give their workers at least 2 weeks' notice of their work schedule. When I talk to folks who aren't familiar with those industries, they're often very surprised to discover that it's not at all uncommon for, you know, someone who works in a grocery store, for example, to get their work schedule on Thursday for the week starting Sunday. So that kind of unpredictability and volatility in schedules really makes it very difficult for folks and also for businesses because it results in high turnover. So Fair Work Week ordinances require a certain amount of advance notice and a variety of other things. And my dissertation chair, Susan Lambert, was really the mother of all of those ordinances. So when I left, finished my PhD at UChicago, I went to Washington University in St. Louis and really broadened my research even beyond scheduling practices and really focused in on the relationship between job characteristics and business outcomes for employers. And we conducted a really great study with our partner, the National Fund for Workforce Solutions, with generous support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which you and I will talk about, I think, a little later about the job quality maps, which is one of the things that came out of that work. And what that allowed us to do was really to build out a summary of, you know, 40, 50 years of research that, you know, we reached a point where they received additional funding. And it was really my opportunity to blend my experience and background in academic research with my role as a practitioner and consultant. And so in March of 21, I launched Work, and we are now a small but mighty team of three full-time and several part-time folks who really work to continue to do this research and also to work on the ground with, well, often employers who are portfolio companies of private equity firms. And we still conduct original research as well, which we're conducting a study right now with support from the Ford Foundation Mission Investments team, looking at the role of human capital management in private equity value creation and where do quality jobs fit into that strategy. So that's my background.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you for that. And a lot of your work, and when you go into your writing, talks about what a good job is and what this notion of a good job is. Can you just help us better understand what you mean by a good job?
Yeah, there are a lot of really great models of what is a quality job out there. I think we went through it recently and we found 12 high quality models out floating out in the ecosystem. Some of the ones that I particularly like are from Jobs for the Future, the Good Jobs Institute, the Aspen Institute, and Iris Plus has a nice framework that's part of the GIIN, the Global Impact Investing Network. So what we discovered in going across these 12 models that we found was that there are major themes that cross across all of them, and they include pay and benefits, opportunities for growth and advancement, you know, meaningfulness in your role, and also kind of a catch-all category I call sort of like, what's it like on the job? And so each of those we can dig into a little bit further, but those are kind of the overarching characteristics. And you can see that applies, you know, far beyond just the front line, but to all workers, whether they're actual employees or gig workers or contract workers, et cetera.
Cool. And when you have been doing this work, how have you kind of been measuring the quantitative and the qualitative impact of a good job? I mean, what does the research show? What does the academic literature show? What does your research show? It'd be great to kind of dig into some of these various characteristics of a good job, whether it's adequate pay or benefits or growth, training, and advancement, because I feel like everyone wants that in their jobs. It's easy to see how that's good for the individual, but there's a lot of benefit for society as well, for the firm and for society. And so maybe if we could just dig into the link between a good job and business outcomes to start, and then maybe a little later, the societal outcomes as well.
Sure, absolutely. And as I mentioned, you know, there's 40 decades of really strong academic research that demonstrates the strong correlations between job characteristics, things that we just discussed, and business outcomes. And that includes, you know, the kind of human capital KPIs that we think about, like turnover, like burnout, engagement. And there are ways that, you know, we know these are frequently measured within organizations, right? Like HRIS systems capture things about, you know, voluntary turnover, involuntary turnover. We capture information about internal promotions, right? So there's a lot of data contained within people software systems. There's also, beyond the human capital KPIs, there are also financial KPIs that have been studied. So things like stock price, return on assets, credit risk. So when you're looking at large, particularly public companies, there's very strong research that demonstrates correlations between companies that have, you know, high levels of job satisfaction or high levels of employee engagement and these better financial outcomes as compared to, you know, for example, with stock price, as compared to a portfolio of companies that have lower levels of job satisfaction. And when we talk about measuring, you know, job quality from the perspective of workers themselves, there's a good body of research that demonstrates that self-reports often are very aligned with the actual data that you can look at objectively. So, for example, there's research that shows when you ask people, how are you performing on the job, and they give their own self ratings. Studies have then compared what managers of those workers, how they have rated them in performance reviews. And the alignment between those two is surprisingly strong, right? People think, oh, they'll exaggerate on a survey. But the truth is, it's very well correlated. So when we want to understand the quality of jobs in a lot of our work, you know, we're going directly to the source, to employee voice. And when you ask people about, you know, quality of jobs, the way we approach this is to look at questions that are directly related to human capital and financial KPIs. You know, so for example, in the Gallup Q12, which is a very well-known and well-validated instrument, there is a question about, I have a best friend at work. And this is an indicator of how people, you know, feel about their jobs and engagement, et cetera. The challenge with questions like that is that they're not very actionable. You know, what do I do as an employer about whether or not you have a best friend at work? But some of the kinds of questions that we will ask are things like, I can count on my supervisor to help me when I have a problem. So if the answer to that is no, that's very actionable for the employer. And we know from enormous amounts of research that perceived supervisor support is strongly correlated with all the kinds of outcomes that businesses care about, as well as being good for, you know, worker well-being.
Okay, interesting. I feel like you and I could go back and forth on the academic side for a while and go deep into this. I think there's kind of this cultural moment right now in the US where folks really feel like they've been left behind on both sides of the aisle, right? Regardless of political persuasion. I was actually reading this article. I don't know where was it from. I think it was in the New York Times or somewhere else that was kind of talking about this music from Oliver Anthony, which is almost like, you know, music you might hear from Bob Dylan or Neil Young. Very angry about, I don't know if you've heard this guy. I mean, I'd never heard of him in Europe, but he's apparently a kind of a phenom in the US right now. And my gut reaction to it was, wow, this guy is just super angry and I don't understand this. But at the same time, there seems to be this cultural moment where, you know, a lot of people feel like they have been left behind. A lot of people feel like their opportunity is diminishing. And even if they don't think about that purely from a financial perspective, they feel like they don't have a lot of meaning in work, right? And I'm wondering if the academic literature is so strong that shows the tie between individual performance and happiness on the job or satisfaction with one's work and firm performance is so high, how did we get to this cultural moment where so many people are dissatisfied with their work?
That is a really important question. And I think as you and I have talked about, people feel left behind because they have been left behind. You know, there's been a decoupling with firm productivity and employee wages over the last, say, you know, 30 years. These macroeconomic forces, you know, I think we can tie that back to, you know, the embrace of a neoliberal economic perspective. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons why I think, whereas, you know, in the days of strong unions and strong collaboration between workers and management, you know, you had much higher job satisfaction. And, you know, you also had very good returns. Now, I'm not saying there were not inefficiencies or ways that, you know, business could be improved over time, but there was a relationship between workers and leadership, management, owners of the company, that there was a recognition that we're both in this together and we both contribute to the success. And this transition to looking at workers not as an asset to the company, but as a cost to the company, you know, I think drives a lot of what we see. And there's some great work that has been done around the ways in which financial accounting is very detrimental to the effort to look at workers as an asset, right? Because workers are not actually an asset of the company. They are not owned. So if I, for example, own, you know, a manufacturing facility and I upgrade that with, you know, state-of-the-art robotics, that investment, I have a tax benefit of that investment. And that does me good on my balance sheet. Well, if I then pay to upgrade the skills of my workforce so they can learn how to operate all this state-of-the-art technology, the dollars that I put into that investment in my workforce, it doesn't do me any good. It doesn't show up on my balance sheet. I get no tax benefit from it. So there's sort of a structural built-in disincentive in that regard where, you know, it's not that it doesn't pay off for the employer, but it doesn't pay off as much as, for example, outsourcing that, where now I have a different expense on my balance sheet because I'm hiring a company to support me. So now I bring in workers who aren't my employees, but I get a benefit from that. There's also, I think, there's a perception that good jobs are expensive for a company. Yeah, we have to pay benefits. We have to pay higher wages. So if we can reduce those costs, that's good for the bottom line. And it is true that there are, you know, business models that, you know, take what we call a low road approach. So low cost, low margins, low prices to consumers, and they can make a profit in that way. You know, I would argue that the evidence suggests they can't be successful over the very long term in that way, looking at you, Kmart. But I do think that the other approach, what we call the high road approach, is it has a more sustainable competitive advantage for those companies. But it does mean that we don't spend all of our effort trying to minimize, you know, our labor cost line when we're looking at our expenses. So if we think about, oh, bad jobs are inevitable because that's the only way that we can make a profit, well, that's a fallacy because we know there are thriving companies that offer good jobs. And if you're, you know, business model relies on exploitation of workers, you need a new business model, right? And I think that our systems where we, you know, for example, the minimum wage has lagged behind the cost of living so dramatically that it is a poverty level wage. when we offer poverty level wages, we create problems for our workers, right? I can't afford reliable transportation. I'm late to work. I don't show up at all. I quit my job because I can't get there. Now, as an employer, I've got to hire someone new, or I put my workers under stress because somebody called off because they couldn't get to work. So poverty level wages have big impacts, but the cost of turnover, for example, doesn't show up on the balance sheet. So I look at it and say, well, I'll just de-skill this job so that I can just train someone very quickly to step in and take over, as though a human being and all of their institutional knowledge and their ability to be, you know, a contributing part of a team, as though that has no value and they're just a widget that I can plug in and, you know, take out at will.
Actually, that's a really, it's funny, you basically just read my mind, something I wanted to ask you about, which is, how much of this is the result of two things? Because you mentioned the ghost that's in the room right now, neoliberalism. I always like, when someone brings it up, I always like to make it very concrete, right? Like, what do you mean exactly, right? And then one on that front, how much of it is sort of this reform that some folks call neoliberalism since the 80s, late 70s? And then couple that with this other thing that I guess you could say is ascendant or maybe descendant, is this gig economy idea, right? I can think of nothing better than making workers fungible than things like this gig economy, right? Where you're like, well, I mean, you get to set your own schedule and be a swappable cog in my machine, right? From a real almost Taylorist perspective. So those two things, how do they sort of play into this, you know, what you're talking about here about how we just have we don't have a lack of good jobs now. Like at the same time, you have these two incentives sort of eating at that, right? Is that part of the picture?
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up gig workers. I want to sort of address this in two ways. I think that the neoliberal economic piece of it, you know, when we talk about like supply and demand curves meet in the middle. And when we look at labor, the supply of labor, the demand for labor, where they intersect, that is the prevailing market wage, except that we have market failure. Right. So, and today is a great example right now with this labor market. When the supply of workers is low, and therefore the price of labor in order to reach equilibrium would have to rise, you get, I would say, you know, economists and, you know, business suddenly going against neoliberal principles and saying we need market intervention. You know, if we reach equilibrium, we can't possibly make a profit. Now, wait a minute. Let's talk about that. And let's look at, you know, executive compensation and stock buybacks, et cetera. But when we say, oh, we actually don't believe that those principles work, so we need to increase the labor supply, like, for example, by loosening regulations on child labor. You all may have seen the stories about that. You know, then we're doing a little bit of the hypocrisy dance and saying we believe in markets when it serves employers, but we don't believe in markets when it gives power to workers. You know, on the side, when you look at gig economy, a big piece of what goes on there is like, you know, why would Uber benefit from that model? Well, it's because labor protections don't apply to 1099 workers, right? And the employer doesn't have to contribute to Social Security and Medicare for those workers. So we have policy incentive that exists to basically make it sensible for employers to say, we're not going to have you, you know, on our payroll. And additionally, you know, those folks are not eligible for a lot of the kinds of workplace, you know, protections we talk about, or unemployment insurance, for example. So when we have a policy structure that creates incentives, like, we shouldn't be surprised when businesses respond to that. When we have, you know, what Jacob Hacker refers to as a divided welfare state, where, you know, people with more privilege work for the Fortunate 500, get their health insurance through their employer. You know, people who are truly economically disadvantaged get their health care through Medicaid, and the elderly through Medicare. And we have this group in the middle, we've been left behind group, who, you know, they do now have access to health insurance through Obamacare, but health insurance is still very expensive. So when we've created a structure where employers bear the cost of providing health insurance for workers, we shouldn't be surprised when employers look for ways that can, you know, support cutting that expense in their business model. Now, if we had universal healthcare, not just for the poor, not just for the elderly, you would see different calculation. You wouldn't have, you know, an Uber or a Lyft saying we need gig workers, because they wouldn't be bearing the cost of those employees having those kinds of benefits that really make a difference to their lives and that are harder for companies to quantify in terms of the benefit that they get.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point too, because when you begin to look at some of the folks who fund your work as well, like, we're not talking about, you know, this isn't some necessarily like activist organization that's, you know, up against, you know, us and them, what have you. You're actually, you've got a lot of really smart and well-funded folks who are saying, actually, this is a serious problem. So I'm curious to learn a bit more about some of the tools that you use to show the quantitative side of this, right? Like, you're talking about a really obvious qualitative measurements here, but over the last, you know, few decades of research, a decade and a half that you've been at this, how have you been able to prove this, you know, prove this out as having a quantitative impact? Because when I think about this example we're talking about with Uber, right, and like the swapping and fungibility there, if you were able to measure in some way the resilience of the average gig worker, right, you could see this pop up in a number of places, right? Maybe it's like the people who are looking for special exemptions for early Medicaid or Medicare roles in a particular state or what have you, right? There are various ways to visualize this. You're an actual researcher, so I'm curious to know now, like, maybe to make this question really succinct, is given that you're a qualitative and quantitative researcher, mixed methods researcher from the sound of it, what have you been able to see that you can point to and say, like, this is a serious case of, you know, declining the impacts of having a good job on the economy? And then what's the opposite side of that case? Like, what does that look like quantitatively? And maybe even use the gig folks as an example, if you like.
Yeah, and I guess I hear this a lot, particularly, you know, we've been working with some impact investing firms. So they're private equity, but they have a mission to have social impact, and their portfolio companies to look at how to improve quality jobs. And as I've been kind of infiltrating this impact investing world, I hear all the time two things. Number one, well, there's no research that shows that making jobs better is going to help our business, you know, to which I want to like bang my head on the keyboard. I'm like, no, there's a ton of it. You just don't know about it. And the other thing we hear is like, well, these are squishy things and they're harder to measure than financial things. So since we can't really measure it, it's just harder for us to integrate it into, you know, our processes and operational reviews, you know, for example. But there are good ways to measure. And we've talked about some of them, you know, both in terms of what companies collect as part of, you know, their payroll systems, their human resource information systems. There's also, you know, lifting up employee voice and employee listening. That is not a squishy thing when you use a rigorously designed survey instrument, which is how we do things, right? But there's also, you know, for example, there's a great study that was out of Harvard, and it's Aaron Bernstein and Larry Bieferman. And this was a number of years ago, but they looked at the materiality of human capital to corporate financial performance. And it's a great review of the academic research literature. And they find correlations between human capital measures and, as I was saying, total shareholder return, profitability, Tobin's Q, which I don't know what that is, but apparently it's something worth mentioning. We had a study that came out in the CFA Institute Financial Analyst Journal that looked at employee satisfaction and long-run stock returns from 1984 to 2020. And, you know, this was unequivocal, very strong evidence that the companies that had higher employee satisfaction, which of course is one of the things you see when you have better jobs, you know, with returns in the stock market. So there's an element here, I think, of, I'm not going to say willful ignorance, but it's a counter narrative that requires a change in business practices, right? If you say, we have evidence that improving the quality of jobs, or for example, treating gig workers not as gig workers, but making them employees, that this will, there is evidence that this will pay off in these ways, and we can measure this. Well, that requires you to rethink a business model, to change your business practices, and it's hard, right? So, it's working the way we're doing it now. Sure, you're telling me there could be additional returns, but I don't want to be the first mover to take that risk. So, part of what we hope for, particularly in the research that we do that's with philanthropic funding, is to be able to de-risk those first movers with data and a playbook that shows them how they can achieve those goals and basically help to build the business case. But ultimately, if people do not want to either work hard at these changes or believe the business case for whatever the reasons may be. It doesn't matter how much data I bring to the table.
Well, I think this is like one last spot that I think is super interesting, because you mentioned you started that last segment a bit by talking about private equity. We were connected through a private equity practitioner, if you will, Justin Kulev, TCP Group, which, you know, shout out to him. But one thing I wanted to ask you real quick is, how much of this push from private equity do you see on the ownership side? Like, how much of that, you know, maybe break it down two ways, how much of having a good job is making sure you have some stake in the upside, but whether it's intrinsic or extrinsic, and how are you seeing that in the broader market with the folks who are stakeholders of your research?
Well, there's excellent research, a lot of it out of Rutgers, that looks at the relationship between employee ownership and all kinds of really beneficial effects, both for employers and for employee owners. And there are a range of different kinds of models, as you know, of what broad-based ownership can look like. And it doesn't seem to matter what the model is. It's an overall good. So we have good friends over at the Democracy at Work Institute that work with a small private equity firm called Apis and Heritage, who I think you all are familiar with as well. Their model, when they are, and it's generally they're acquiring from a founder or family that is exiting a business, they specifically target businesses that have large employee populations, lower level workers of color. And the way they go about that private equity model is what they call ELBO, an employee-led buyout. They convert them to an ESOP. And the Democracy at Work Institute is a partner with them, because just making people an owner, you know, giving them some kind of ownership stake, is not enough to reap the benefits for the business or for the workers. There's a great deal of both education that needs to happen for employees, but there's also a big change that needs to happen for managers. So as an employee, when I gain an ownership stake, depending upon the structure, I gain ownership rights. That means that I have a right to certain information about how the business is doing. Well, first of all, if I don't know I have that right, I can't exercise it, right? So there's a piece of education for workers. But if I also can't understand that information because nobody's ever showed me how to read a balance sheet, for example, then I don't have the information I need to act as an owner in a way that will benefit the business. Additionally, you know, when we think about managers, if I have never been a co-owner of a business with my staff, I have, you know, ways of doing things that, you know, need to change, right? Yes, I'm still the manager, but now we're all the boss, right? So the support of managers in making this change is really crucial. And this is something that, you know, you're familiar with in terms of, you know, KKR and Pete Stavros's investment in creating Ownership Works, a nonprofit that supports companies that are pursuing their particular type of broad-based ownership, which, you know, I should say, the Democracy at Work Institute focuses a great deal on co-op models of ownership, you know, Apis and Heritage and others, ESOPs. And when you look at KKR's model, it's different. I think it reflects sort of almost like stock options. You know, if the stock does well, you get to reap the benefits of that, you know, when they exit the firm. But they put in a great deal of work to not only teach employees about these topics and ownership, but also to really try to demonstrate on the ground that you have decision-making power here. And it's sort of the ultimate expression of employee voice, right? It's one thing to ask me as an employee for my input. It's another thing to actually act on that input. Well, as an owner, I do have a right to both be heard, but also to have some role in the decision making. So I think I may have gotten a little bit lost there, but I think that one thing that we know is that employee owned companies are more likely to have high quality jobs, and they also have really good financial returns. So if you want to say that's a coincidence, okay, but you know, the evidence is pretty strong there.
I'm interested in going a little deeper on the private equity piece. So if you take like the history of the cooperative model, and you think about the cooperative as bundling together ownership rights and voice rights through governance, that's been the dominant model in broad-based ownership in Europe, right? Through this co-determination model, where as a company scales in Scandinavia and in Germany and in the Netherlands and to a certain set in other European countries, the labor gets a right on the board. And that could be anywhere from, you know, an eighth of the board up to 50% of the board, with the kind of the tie-breaking vote going to the owners in Germany through super advisory boards. In this, one of the, and the reason why I'm interested in kind of digging in on this, on the kind of the APIS model versus the KKR model, is a lot of what has changed around the structure of the economy since the 70s, right, is that even if we have more opportunity through legal structure to create broad-based ownership, that ownership is often decoupled from voice rights or governance. And whereas we may have had a more antagonistic relationship between management and labor, you know, in the post-war period up through the 70s, that you actually saw a tighter coupling of productivity and wage growth. Whereas now you have, you know, a decline in unions, you have that decoupling of productivity and wage growth. And so to a certain extent, it seems that perhaps that's due to a decline in union power or the general kind of negotiating power of labor. But I wonder, in your own research, have you been able to tease that out based on these different types of private equity firms that are taking different models and structuring their deals, some with more information or voice rights, whether that's through a minority position on the board or something else, or versus those that are just thinking about, okay, how do we provide some incentive and upside to employees through kind of an ownership right, however that's structured legally?
That is a study I would love to do. So for all of your listeners who are philanthropic funders and interested in ownership, I think it's a really important question, because what you just described, I think, is a really, you know, when we look at the cooperative model where there's much more engagement, and as you were saying, in terms of, you know, decision making and having a voice in leadership on the board, et cetera, you know, the ESOP model, as you know, it was a wonderful idea that kind of came in through the back door with ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, that created a number of great opportunities, but also a lot of barriers for, you know, how companies will actually enact that on the ground and engage worker voice. The model that you have with APIS and Heritage or with KKR, it very much depends on the private equity firm's sort of theory and approach, right? Because you can invest as a private equity partner in that kind of education for workers. You can choose to have a model that requires an employee on the board like APIS and Heritage. A model that's more like the KKR model don't have those same level of governance rights, but there's, you know, enormous upside for folks who wouldn't have the opportunity for wealth building. But I'm not aware of studies that have been done to look at outcomes with those three different models. And comparatively, I mean, certainly the KKR, the ownership work model, is relatively new. You know, they've been executing it over a number of years, but exits are fairly recent, I think. So I'm not aware of studies that compare that, but certainly the other research that, for example, demonstrates the power of worker voice and worker participation, like, for example, in manufacturing, where workers are in, you know, they have a great deal of autonomy and decision-making authority about how the work gets done. When you have models of that sort and you see really great results, you know, we can do some translation and say, you know, it would appear that the more workers have the opportunity to, you know, and we see this in other research, to have the say about what they do on the job and how they get the work done, the better the results tend to be, right? So I think it makes sense to me that you would probably see stronger results where people have more opportunity to participate in governance, but I'm not aware of current research on that.
Cool. The other thing that was kind of interesting to me, just coming back to the conversation, I guess it's more kind of on the macro side. You know, one of the tensions that Jahad and I often talk about kind of off the pod, both of us live in Europe, but both of us are Americans, is, you know, the amount of innovation and kind of venture financing that goes into kind of these new areas, whether it's AI or climate tech, et cetera, in the US versus, I think we had last week on the pod, I think she's the first solo woman GP in Europe, which is just crazy, or the second, which is just, like, you know, ridiculous for 2023. But at the same time, so historically, what has been kind of the argument is that, oh, you put in place these better protections for workers and you're going to have a less robust economy. And I think in some respect that comes through when you look at venture financing, although I think it's changing. And historically, people, you know, from University of Chicago or other institutions like that would make the argument that, well, it also comes through on kind of the participation rate in the labor force. But you now see this kind of decoupling between Europe and the US in the participation rate in the labor force. This is the percentage of the kind of working adults that are actually participating in the labor force, where the US is actually far behind Europe at this point. And I think every other advanced democracy at this point, in terms of what percentage of the of labor is actually, you know, has work today. Do you think that's a function of not having good jobs? Or do you think there's other structural issues within the US that's causing more and more people to drop out of the labor force?
I think you point to a really interesting, what could look like a paradox, which is that in Western European economies, you know, social democracies, where you have a much more robust social safety net, where essentially you have, you know, what is it, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, your BATNA. If I'm a worker in Europe and I don't like what my employer or what employers are doing, and I choose to leave the labor force, it's not a generous living that's available to me, but my, you know, likelihood of falling into poverty is not nearly as high as it would be in the US. So you might say to yourself, oh, in Europe, where the alternative to not working a job is really not so terrible, you would expect to have lower participation rates than in the US, where if you don't have a job, you know, you're lucky if you qualify for SNAP, which is, you know, food stamps, supplemental nutritional assistance program. Yet that's not what we see, right? But COVID is a really interesting case study there. When we had pandemic relief and, you know, to workers who were suddenly out of a job, you had a circumstance where when the economy started to open again, but pandemic relief was still sort of in play in the economy, people still had some money in the bank, there was a much lower willingness to accept bad jobs. And employers had to respond by raising wages and, you know, improving the quality of those jobs. So in that situation, it mirrors what Western Europe has, where there is a better option. The reason I think, you know, when you talk about lower participation rates, if you compare the quality of your typical job in Western Europe to the quality of your typical lower level job in the US, you know, I think you'd see a gap. So when the alternative was pandemic relief and not having to potentially have your family be out on the street, people were not willing to work in poor quality jobs. As we pull those, you know, those supports back, it's probably no surprise that we're going to see an increase in participation rates. But I think that, you know, that paradox is interesting to say, well, if what the problem is the people, and we hear this a lot, well, people just don't want to work. You know, people are, they don't have a work ethic. And of course, the underlying question there is, well, what people are we talking about, right? But when we say things like that, we center the problem in the workforce participation and other things within the individual. But you look at the structural factors and say, well, if you were in this situation with this set of constraints and this set of incentives, what would you do? You know, I once had an interview. This was a home health agency where we were looking at the quality of those jobs. So these are folks who are out in the field. Their assignments vary dramatically, right? Because someone recovers or goes into the hospital, the home health aide is no longer needed. They're assigned to a different patient. So there's a lot of instability in the job. It's a difficult job, just even day to day. And it's often tough for those folks to get as many work hours as they want. At the same time, because the wages are so low, a significant portion of that workforce is Medicaid eligible. So they get their health insurance, not from an employer, but through the federal government, and they don't pay anything for it, right? So those employees, this leader was expressing frustration that, you know, well, I could give them 30 hours a week instead of 24 hours a week. Notice she wasn't saying a full-time job, 40 hours a week. I could give them 30 hours a week, but they don't want more hours because at 30 hours, you know, they qualify for our benefits and then they lose their Medicaid. Well, you know, our health insurance is decent health insurance. If they just worked more hours, if they were willing to work enough hours, they could have their own health insurance and, you know, not be on government support. Well, let's do the math for a second on that. I remember sitting there thinking, I'm not quite sure how that works. If I get 30 hours a week and your private health insurance that I have to pay for am I coming out ahead of my 24 hours a week with getting Medicare, where I then also at 24 hours a week may be better able to balance my outside commitments, like, for example, children? So this is, you know, we want to talk about neoclassical economics. This is a, you know, rational actor in the market. But when we create these kinds of incentives and then say, well, the problem is the people, we're centering the wrong mechanism to change the economic outcomes we're looking for.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think just going back, I think like on a lighter note, right? Like it's just in terms of the, one of the things that comes across for me in the US is how much the poor kind of attack each other, the working poor, I guess is a better way to put it, attack each other, right? And this is something that came out for me in this song as well. You have, you know, this guy complaining about the lack of good jobs. And in the same song, he's yelling at people that are on food stamps, right? And for me, what a lot of this comes down to, we can talk about the academic literature, we can talk about the correlation between individual performance and firm performance, and individual performance and societal performance, which I want to go into a little bit more detail. But it seems to me that there's this general feeling that there is not a lot of dignity in work, and we're losing dignity in work for a large portion of the kind of the economy in the US. And one of the things that strikes me as different between Europe and the US is you don't have as big a spread between the rich and the poor in the US. And I think one of the qualitative impacts that one feels when living in a society like that is that you can identify more with people that aren't in your social class, right? Because it doesn't feel like the economy is bifurcated. And so if, look, this is not academic, right? This is not rigorous, but just from a visceral perspective, every time I go back to the US versus Europe, the feeling that I have is that it feels like we have increasingly two separate societies. And if I'm not part of that society that's winning, and all I see when I open up YouTube or I open up, you know, I put on Netflix is a group of people that are winning, I would want to drop out of the labor force as well. Forget opioids, forget like all these other structural issues. There's this psychological attack that is consistently, you know, or it's a psychological pressure that's consistently on top of me, regardless of my need to pay bills or regardless of kind of some of the more complicated structural issues of the economy. And that's what really came out to me in this song, was kind of this underlying anger of, you know, feeling like, you know, I'm a human being, I should have some dignity in my work.
I think you're hitting on something really important. And we're going to get, I think, a little bit into political economy as well, which is, you know, so bad jobs don't grow out of the ground like trees. Companies create them, which means that companies can create good jobs as well. So if we've created a circumstance where there is a lack of dignity in a lot of different kinds of work, but, you know, companies and, you know, our society has allowed that to occur, that means we can choose something else. And if we aren't choosing something else, it's important to ask why. And I do think from, you know, a political economy perspective, when we center, you know, corporations as acting in ways that is all for the benefit of society. Well, if we raise wages, we'll go out of business and then everybody loses their job. If that narrative is embraced, you know, the message there is like, well, too bad. The job you get is the job you get. And if you don't like it, you know, oh, well, too bad for you. But when you look at worker power and you say, well, why do we not have, you know, more organizing happening? And, you know, we can talk separately about the ways in which the labor movement has, you know, been attacked and evolved over time. But the political economy piece of this is where you divide people in the culture wars, you elevate existing, you know, an underlying racist sentiment and divide people by race in this country, which, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that this nation and this economy was built on slavery. The United States does not exist without the institution of slavery. So we have a long history of accepting that some people, it's okay for them to have terrible conditions and bad work, while other people, you know, we won't permit that to occur in the same kind of a way. But when we divide, you know, the, you know, as you were saying, kind of the working poor in a way, you know, that pits one group against another group, they don't organize to address the structural factors, like, for example, bad labor practices, poor regulation of labor. And instead, there's discord. You know, I think that some of what I think about often is that there's no question that I would be categorized as a member of the elite. Right. I have a PhD. I am a white woman with a great deal of privilege. And I spend my entire career working to make lower level jobs better. Well, it's not just people of color who are in those jobs. The gentleman singing that song and complaining about lack of dignity in work is someone I am striving to help. So when we have a political environment where we split people up into groups, the only entities or people that are served are those who are, sitting at the very top. And, it's a great strategy if you want to avoid, paying more taxes or having, lower stock value in your portfolio of, millions or billions, but it's not good for our overall society. And when people lament, we're on the verge of, a chaos, a breakdown, there was an insurrection at our Capitol, you ask yourself why, and don't start to center the people are the problem here, because we have structures that we have put in place and agreed to as a society. And that's one of the most important sites of change.
Makes sense. I feel like sometimes this podcast is a Disney movie, right? We get into it, everyone's happy. We introduce a monster. Everyone's like, oh, wow, this is not good. So we need to bring it back to a Hollywood ending here.
No, it's funny because I thought, I'm sure I'll let you do the Hollywood ending, but I thought it was like really interesting what you pointed out. Like, just even if I think about my own Netflix consumption, which I hate television, but I'm forced to partake 1 hour a night just because that's how the family congregates. There is like a really, maybe it's just my content consumption, but it's a very clear division in terms of like European stories that happen in Europe versus stories that happen in the US, right? Like, just you can clearly see it post-COVID as well, that there's very obvious class lines between like where people live, what kind of cars they drive, the kinds of problems they have, versus when you're trying to tell one type of story versus another one. Where in Europe, like Martin said, like if I go to a bar, the family office guy who's like a 100 millionaire is going to be going to the same bar in Spain. Yeah, he might go to like the rooftop later or something at some luxury brand, but like fundamentally his options are mostly the same as mine. They're accessible. But I will kick it over to you, sir.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's just, the more I see that, and it's not just in Europe, even living in Asia. I mean, like there's a lot of great things about the US, but I feel like every time I go back more and more, this kind of hits me viscerally, this bifurcated economy. Cool. Hollywood ending here. Let's get back to the Disney movie. So one of the good things about this challenge is that if you look at the figures around labor productivity, right? So if we just look at these figures briefly, again, labor productivity and wages were tied together fairly closely. And just for the audience, again, labor productivity, when you're looking at an economy level, is national income divided by hours worked, right? And so you really want wages to be somewhere near productivity. What's happened in the past 10 or 15 years is that income growth has stagnated versus productivity growth. But one of the nice things that I really liked about your work is, and kind of this general space, Ellen, is that you don't shy away from the fact that people need to skill up, and you don't shy away from the fact that we need automation, and we need kind of like a component of better jobs is skilling up the labor force as well. And that's a tension that we talk a little bit about on the podcast a lot as we think about who owns kind of the digital economy. Maybe you could just tell us kind of why the average citizen, the average taxpayer, when they're thinking about good jobs at the economy level, why they should care about this. Like, even if you've got a great banking job, or you've got a great job as a funded entrepreneur or a creative that's making a lot of money, why should you care about this? And, from the perspective of what's good for it, from the perspective of people that may not be the working poor, or even the frontline workers, or the people who are part of the management teams that are working with those particular workers.
I think there's two ways to look at that. One is very macro, right? Like if we have thriving communities where people have good jobs, they earn enough money to go out and spend it in their communities. I earn enough that I can go to the movies, and my movie theater has business and thrives. We can look at a very high level and say, when our fellow citizens are not at the edge of poverty, there are many, many good things that happen from that. But we can also look at it at the micro level, right? Whatever my job is, reasonable probability I go to the grocery store, you know, reasonable probability that I engage in public in some way. Well, when we pursue a business model that looks at workers as a cost to be minimized, and we de-skill the jobs in order to accommodate high levels of turnover that are, you know, going to happen with poor pay, et cetera, then you have people who are A, not well trained to do a good job, and who are not invested in doing a good job. So if I go to the grocery store and I say, you know, hey, where are the pickles? If someone is A, brand new, because turnover is high, and they don't know where the pickles are, you know, I might be annoyed, but also feel bad for this person. You just asked me a question, and as a worker, I couldn't do a good job. You can also say, well, you know, as somebody who's a customer, if I get good service, you know, I am more likely to shop at that business. If that business is in my community, that's good for me. You know, who wants to live in a neighborhood where you can't run out to the grocery store? You know, who wants to, you know, order something online and have a package whipped at your door where what's inside might break because the person who's doing that delivery doesn't care at all? When people have the opportunity to contribute and add value to businesses, you know, in my experience and in the research that I've seen, people will step up. There's very few people who go to work in the morning and say, you know, I really want to do a shitty job. Oops, can I say that on the podcast? Let me rephrase. There are very few people who go to work in the morning and say, I just feel like doing a bad job today. I don't want to give good customer service. I don't want to be knowledgeable and feel good about, you know, what I'm able to do in this job. That just doesn't happen. Whatever your role is, people want to do a good job. If you've ever gone through a grocery checkout line, you know, somebody goes through before you, they don't talk to the person who's checking them out. They're still on their cell phone. They go through. The person next goes through and says, hey, how's your day going? And the cashier may say a few things. They're still checking that person out. If there's some kind of like minor pleasant exchange, that worker, you know, who didn't have to have that, may feel a little bit better about their job that day. And when it's my turn to go through, I'm not dealing with a surly checkout person. I'm dealing with someone who is, hey, how is your day going today? Now they've asked me. And my experience as a customer is more positive. So, you know, I think that when we look at what are the benefits to good jobs, it's around us every single day.
Awesome. I feel like we should end on that note because it's so positive. I wanted to go into a bit of detail on automation and good jobs, but I feel like I covered a bunch of it here today. We're going to have you at the Ownership Economy Summit. We're also going to have Jan Ekka on that panel and Sarah Horowitz. So I think we can go into a lot on automation with those two. Can't wait to have you three together, which is going to be phenomenal. So where can folks follow you online? I know we've got a lot of your material in the show notes, but where can people follow your writing and your work?
So, of course, I always appreciate when people follow me on LinkedIn. We are often linking to the work of others, but to ours as well. And our website is workimpact.com. That's W-O-R-C impact.com. And that is because we are the Workforce and Organizational Research Center. And we often get sucked in by the puns and say, let's get to work. So I appreciate folks following the research and the interest of you guys. I'm really excited to come and speak at the conference.
Think you can hit.